Board, please. Now driving.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Four Please Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. I'm your host, Marty Smith from ESPN. Tuesday at the Masters meant a noticeable increase in practice intensity as players prepare for the 87th edition of golf's premier event. On today's episode, you'll hear from numbers 1, 2, 3, and 5 in the World Golf Rankings. That means Max Homa, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, and defending Masters champion Scottie Scheffler. You'll also hear from Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, who have 8 green jackets between them. Before we detail the players' thoughts as we head towards tournament play, Augusta National Golf Club released the groupings for Thursday and Friday here on Tuesday. The first group tees off at 8 a.m. as 2003 Masters champion Mike Weir joins Kevin Na. 5-time Masters champion Tiger Woods tees off at 10:18 alongside Victor Hovland and Xander Schauffele. At 10:42 a.m., Justin Thomas, John Rahm, and Cameron Young tee off. Former Masters champion Danny Willett, Gary Woodland, and Brooks Koepka tee off at 11:54. At 12:24, 3-time Masters champion Phil Mickelson joins Tom Hoge and Siwoo Kim. 2020 Masters champion Dustin Johnson, Corey Connors, and Justin Rose tee off at 1:12. At 1:24, it's Colin Morikawa, Matthew Fitzpatrick, and Will Zalatoris. Defending champion Scottie Scheffler joins Max Homa and amateur Sam Bennett at 1:36 p.m., while Rory McIlroy, Tom Kim, and Sam Burns tee off at 1:48. 2015 Masters champion Jordan Spieth, Tony Finau, and Tommy Fleetwood tee off at 2 p.m. One of the new and difficult challenges those gentlemen will have to face on Thursday as they tee off for the 87th Masters tournament is a new configuration on the 13th, increased from 510 yards to 545, which, as the players will tell you, is a completely new challenge.
The course is playing long. I mean, it's long and it's hard, but it's in great shape. And I actually think with a little bit of weather, a little bit of moisture, like it's going to play long and difficult, but probably easier than if it were dry and fast, I would think. So I think the scoring would be decent, even though it's going to play pretty long. I had a chance to come here last week and spend a couple of days, and I got lucky in that it rained a lot while I was here, and then it broke up, and I had a beautiful afternoon both times and got a chance to see what the way the course will play given the conditions this week. It plays so different when it's wet. You know, the rye grass is, when it's wet, the ball will skid and you can chip. You can glide it through, it'll keep its backspin, but when it's dry and sticky, it grabs, you know, it's into the grain and you really can't chip, you have to putt it from off the green. And so this week we'll be chipping a lot, and I chipped a lot last week and try to get that area of my game sharp. Yeah, it's tough because it's hard to get past the corner to have a shot at the green and not be blocked out by the trees, for me anyways. And we played the front of the tee box today. And I think in perfect conditions, it's probably right on. I think with it being wet, it will be hard to go for it and probably not as risk-reward positive to go for it because the greens are soft and you can still chip it close and it's not really worth the risk. But conversely, you can come into that green with a longer club and stop it. So I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm long enough to get it around the corner and have a clear shot. I tried it today, but I have to hit such a big slice. I may try a different drive rather than hitting a kind of a low rounded cut. I might have to rip one and try to get it past the corner, but I don't know if it's really worth the risk for me. I'm a decent wedge player, and I may just try to make a birdie that way.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting this year just because of the weather. I almost feel like it's not going to show as much risk reward as it probably will if the weather was good. With it being in the 50s and raining and a bit of wind, I'm not sure what direction that's going to be going on that hole. I it's not great for my game. I like to cut it with my driver, and I can turn my 3-wood, and now there's no 3-wood play. But it's a much easier tee shot now. I think I'm going to look at it as a three-shot par 5, and if I happen to hit a good one down the left center, I'll be able to, you know, go for it. But like I said, this year's probably going to be a little bit different, but with everything Augusta's done to their golf course, the changes they've made, I think they have such great standing in like the professionals' view that we know that it's the right decision. You know, it's not like I'm sitting here dissecting the coulda, woulda, shouldas. But I do think this year it's going to play a lot. There's not going to be as many Eagle fireworks, but it's actually a very fun hole. The way we played it yesterday, blocked it a bit off the tee, laid up, and then you have a pretty fun 50-yard pitch, 40-yard pitch, however really far you want to do it. If you want to ship it all the way up greenside, you can do that. It's just going to be hard to take that shot on to the green now, obviously, with the creek there. So I think it'll probably play a bit more benign in the chaos. Scoring average will probably be a little bit similar because part of the older tee is you're bringing a lot of trouble into play for the guys who could hit it up over the corner. And so, you know, some of that is enticing, but you're also going to make eagles up there. So I think the scoring average won't be too different. But I think you'll see a lot more guys laying up this year simply just because of the weather. I think maybe a year we'll get great weather. You'll have a lot more of that in between a 3-4 iron. Are you going to do it? Are you not? And I think that's going to be really entertaining. So, like I said, it's an easier tee shot, and it might play a little bit more like a three-shot hole, but those pitches short of the green are really fun.
Speaking of the green jacket, Scheffler shared his perspective on what it's like to have one, as well as his anticipation to host his first Champions dinner.
I didn't do too much with the jacket. I did bring it on an airplane once on a commercial flight, which was, I don't know if I'm breaking any rules with that, but it was hidden. It definitely went in the Masters champion carry bag as I went through the airport, but I had fun with it. I did the first pitch at a Ranger game. There's a really funny picture of me almost breaking the buttons off the jacket because I forgot to unbutton it and I was throwing out the first pitch. And that was fun. I dropped a hockey puck at a Stars game. It stayed in my closet for a while. I got a closet in my golf room where it was there for a little bit, and then it was in just our regular closet so I could kind of see it every day as it was kind of leading up to the tournament and just enjoy it being in the house. When you see the list of guys when they get into the tournament, how they qualify, and you see lifetime exemption by your name, I think is really cool. And hopefully I'll have the opportunity to be coming back to this place for many years. But just going one day at a time, just trying to enjoy each day. And the drive down Magnolia Lane definitely never gets old. I'm hoping that it's more of a celebration than anything. I don't know what it's been like in years past. For me, I think it's such a special group of guys. And so the opportunity to all be together and just enjoy a meal, just us, is a really, really special opportunity. I don't know many of the guys in the room really well. Some of them, it'll be, you know, some of my very first interactions with them. And so it'll just be kind of just a fun, special night. And I hope that we'll have a good time. I know we're going to eat some good food, and hopefully we'll have a good time. I'll definitely get emotional. I wish I didn't, but I always do. I don't know what it is. The weight of everything kind of hit me as I was leaving the locker room there setting up for the dinner. And I was like, oh, boy, like here it comes. And so I'll definitely get emotional. I still can't believe I'll be sitting in that room. And so it'll be fun. It'll be special. How rare is it to get everybody like that in a room where it's just us? There's nobody else. There's the chairman, and then there's us. And it's such a cool tradition, and I'm just excited to see how it goes. I'm excited to see everybody. I'm excited for the dinner. I'm excited just to hear stories and like I said, hopefully we'll have a good time. I know we're going to have some good food, and it'll be a special evening.
Media sessions continued for many star players Tuesday, and I had the opportunity to chat one-on-one with the only three-time winner on the PGA Tour this year, Jon Rahm. In the past five Masters tournaments, Rahm has carded 9 rounds in the 60s. I asked him what it is about Augusta National that suits his game so well. Suffice to say, the Spaniard doesn't pay much mind to numbers.
You guys always know you in general. Just journalists bring out questions and stats that I never even think about. I think Augusta National is a golf course that, for the most part, lets you play your own game. It gives you options. So it's just staying true to yourself. And, you know, there's something about the golf course that I like. I feel comfortable on the greens, and I feel comfortable around the greens. That's why I think it allows me to be aggressive and post some scores.
You've had a great 2023. How fair would it be to say you're playing the best golf of your life?
I've been able to get wins, but I've had better rounds. I think mentally it's been about as good as it could have been early in the year. But my game could be a lot better. It's just I've been able to get things done. But from how I feel like I was playing, how I feel like I could be playing, there's still a gap.
How confident are you you can earn a green jacket for the first time?
Fairly confident.
And what has to happen in order for that to happen?
I don't want to give you the...
You're not giving up specifics?
No, I don't want to give you the, let's say, silly answer, but shoot one less than the rest, that's fairly fair. It's always difficult to say what can get it done at Augusta National because people have done it in many different ways, right? So again, play your own game is the main thing. Play how you know how to play golf, not the way you're supposed to be playing out here. And I think if you do that, you give yourself a chance.
Best of luck. Always appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Rahm loves the creative freedom that Augusta National offers. Many believe he just may don a green jacket come Sunday. Another player whom many point to as a favorite is four-time major champion Rory McIlroy. Rory, one of the most well-liked and respected athletes alive, maybe ever, enters his 15th Masters still seeking the green jacket and the career Grand Slam that would accompany that green jacket. We started our conversation Tuesday by reliving the unique celebration to his final shot at the 2022 Masters.
No idea. It was spur of the moment. It was so what I wanted to do was throw my club at my bag and celebrate that way, but I forgot what hand my club was in. So I went to throw up my right hand, realized that the club was in my left hand, and then the club went behind me. So probably one of the worst celebrations of my career after probably the best shot.
But now iconic.
Yeah, iconic hopefully in a good way rather than in that way.
You said recently that you left here in 2022 happy for the first time ever. What led to that joy?
You know, I think just... You know, there was a part of my mind that thought I had a real chance to win. That back nine, Scotty still had Amen Corner to play. Everyone's seen what can happen on 12, and, you know, you can hit balls in the water there on 13. And I just felt like, you know, not knowing what he had done through those holes, I just felt, you know, if I could just make another couple of birdies coming in here, I might have a chance. And to feel that way coming up those final few holes and actually being able to produce something, you know, that felt really good. You know, I didn't end up winning, but, you know, in my mind, I walked away from this tournament a winner in some way, because that's the first time I feel like I've really been able to get over that hurdle on this golf course.
What will leave you happy this time?
You know, I think if I go out there and play the way I'm playing, but I think more so than anything else, like, play with that joy that I experienced last year. I think if I play with that joy and I play with almost like that youthful exuberance, I feel like that's the best way to get the best out of yourself here. And if I do that, and if that means that I end up not winning, you know, I'll still be happy with myself that I achieved that goal.
How has your passionate defense of the PGA Tour over the past year impacted your normal?
You know, I took on a lot last year, you know, and it sort of coincided with a few things. It was the first year that I was a board member of the PGA Tour, so I felt a responsibility to the rest of the membership. So, look, I took on a lot, and I think we ended up in a really good place. I think the tour is in a good place. I think the people that did stay on the tour are really... we're all rowing in the same direction. We're all in the same boat. We're all sort of striving for the same things, which in a post-Tiger era is really important. You know, 20 of us equals one of him. And, you know, unfortunately, the PGA Tour can't sell him week in, week out like they used to. So we all collectively have to step up and try to fill that void.
With that very loud voice, I wonder what perspective you've gained about golf and life taking on that initiative.
Yeah, I think it just goes back to my parents and, you know, always telling me to do the right thing. And even when you think no one's watching, because there's always someone watching. And that's the one thing that I always came back to over the last 12 months is if you do the right thing, even if it's the hard thing at times, it'll all work out the way you want it to.
That final answer speaks incredibly well to McIlroy's grace and personality. I've been blessed to interview athletes across the sporting landscape, I've never met anyone who was kinder or more considerate of everyone in his path. While Rory seeks his first green jacket, his good friend and practice buddy, Tiger Woods, has five of them. Entering his 25th Masters this week, I sense a unique humility from Woods just to be here at Augusta National, and a fulfillment to be in the competitive arena on these hallowed grounds in this chapter of his life.
There's been times throughout my career and where I didn't think I'd be back here as a player. But then to come back here as a player and to be able to play, and I've, you know, won one with my back fused, and then obviously coming back here last year after the accident, and you know, I just appreciate this event and what this tournament means and how much has been an important part of my life. Every time you come here, and they make changes to the golf course and to the property, but it looks like they have never touched it. And like I've said before, I think it's just the culture and the camaraderie of the traditions of passing on knowledge and playing practice rounds with some of the greats of the game. For me, as growing up, you know, I was saying in there earlier, you know, I played with Raymond and Freddie. I played with Seve and Ollie. I played with Jack and Arnold. And you know, those are memories for a lifetime. And I was a teenager. And now, again, to play yesterday and today with Freddie, to go out there and play with Rory yesterday and JT today, that's special. But, you know, when it comes game time, the hole goes away and it's time to play.
It's interesting to me that your legacy still being written, you're playing, but so much of it lives right here at Augusta National. What do you hope your legacy is here in the Masters Tournament?
Well, I think that anytime you've been able to play and win this event, you're always going to be part of the history of the Masters. And I was lucky to win my first start as a pro here. You know, my first major championship as a pro, and it happened to be here. And you know, people have no idea what that meant to me. Well, forget I know what it meant to, you know, a lot of other people, but at that time, at that particular time, winning a major gave me 10 years in exemption on the tour. In 98, Mark won twice, and he won the Masters and the British Open and only got 5 years. But at that particular time, be able to have job security for 10 years, when I just had turned pro, I was supposed to be in my junior year in college. This is around spring break time. So instead, I, you know, happened to win the Masters. So just that in itself has allowed me to have, I guess, the ability to not, I was going to always come back here for the rest of my life and be a part of this and be a part of the Champions Dinner, be able to play this golf course for literally for the rest of my life. And that as a 21-year-old, was amazing.
I could be wrong, but I'm rather certain I saw a tear well in his eye when he said that statement. And I don't think I'm wrong. One of Wood's closest confidants his entire career is my wonderful ESPN colleague, Scott Van Pelt. Each year here on Four Please Now Driving, Scott takes time from his chaotic hosting schedule to spend time with us in reflection. And Tuesday, his reflection provided remarkable insight. It is always such a pleasure for me to come to Augusta National and the Masters in April at all. But one of the best parts for me is getting to see this gentleman and spend time in fellowship with my brother from another, the great Scott Van Pelt. First, just share with us the emotions that you get when you walk in here for the first time each year.
I said on our call, the media call that we have, I said it's like Christmas morning. And someone said, "Well, even now?" I said, I mean, I'm in my 50s. I don't wake up on Christmas and go, "Well, hell, I guess we'll go down and do the presents." Right? I mean, right. Well, son of a gun, it's Christmas. Snuck up on me. You know what? I'll be down. Tell the kids I'll see them. I'm going to sleep in. It's Christmas.
It is.
And when you say that, I'm not being flippant. I'm not being sacrilegious. I'm being sincere. It feels the same level of excitement that each year. There's something magical about Christmas morning, even when you don't see it through the eyes of a child yourself, or maybe even you're not seeing it through your children's eyes. Like, Christmas is magic always. So is Augusta National. And and another similarity, I believe, is part of what makes Christmas magical is the memories of the past. Maybe it's people that aren't there any longer, but you remember them with such love and affection. This place, you know, I think about seeing Mr. Palmer, who I got to work for. That's where I started in the Golf Channel, watching him compete and then watching him be a ceremonial first tee participant. And then, you know, he's no longer here, but he's very much here.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? There's something about the past that is still very present, and you just got to be present in your present when you're here and just be grateful. Everyone says the same thing, don't they? Best week of the year. Everybody that's lucky enough to come here and be part of this, you say happy Masters week, because that's what it is, right? It's not a day. Maybe you got a favorite day, but the whole of the week, shoot, we're just so, so blessed.
When you work for Arnold Palmer, mm-hmm. I would imagine you probably have some interesting private moments with a titan, with a legend among legends. What's yours?
This is a great story. And it's a true story. I was going over to his office in Bay Hill. I get goosebumps right now thinking about this. I went over to do some, I don't even know what I was there to do, but I was there to get some sound about something. I saw Mr. Palmer in his office. And there was a man that was in there, and he gave me a look, and I got it. He was having a chat. And I waited outside his office. His door was open. I wasn't eavesdropping, but I'm sitting there. I mean, I can't help but, whatever, be proximate to the conversation. Now, my father worked for a plumbing company, all right? So I'm familiar with the uniform of a man who works for a living. A plaid shirt,
sure.
Jeans, work boots. I recognize that. That's what this man was wearing, who was in there talking to Arnold. I always called him Mr. Palmer. At some point, he told me to call him Arnold. I got there eventually. And this man, I can see that they're having a conversation. And I come to find out after the fact, this was a man who had done a bunch of work laying stone around Bay Hill for him. And apparently part of what he asked for was just to have an opportunity to greet the king. And as he's having his conversation, he's shaking Arnold's hand. And I hear this man say, "Can I just hold on to your hand for a second longer?"
Wow.
And because Arnold Palmer's the king, he says, "Oh, come on now." He gives him like a smack in the arm and says, "Hey, let me hold on to your hand. All the great work you did for us, I can't thank you enough, blah, blah, blah." Makes this guy feel like $1 million. Marty, I watched this man walk out of his office, and I saw a tear going down this man's face. And I don't know one thing about that man, but I'm guessing it had been a while since he had cried, and I'm guessing probably another grown man hadn't ever made him cry. But he walked out of that office with a tear coming down his cheek because he had gotten to shake Arnold Palmer's hand. And I walked in, and I nodded. Mr. Palmer nodded, and nothing was said because it was just an acknowledgement that he knew the power he possessed, and he knew that just by being human and being present with that man in that way meant more than anything could mean, right? And I was just so blown away by how gracious he was and not diffusing that moment, but letting it be. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And I think of it anytime I'm asked, like, what do you remember about Arnold Palmer? I think of that. And I think of one last that's totally different. We did the Arnold Palmer commercial, me and Stuart Scott. He makes an Arnold Palmer. And every time I saw him, I said the same thing. "Mr. Palmer, Scott Van Pelt, it's nice to see you again." I worked for him for the Golf Channel. So when I saw him the morning of that commercial, I said, "Mr. Palmer, Scott Van Pelt, it's nice to see you." He said, "No, I knew you when you had hair." And I just smiled and I said, "Yes, sir, you did." I said, "All right." And so, again, another way for him to find common ground with somebody to give you the needle, right? But he was, he was just, being around him was special because he had an aura that was a magnetism that very few have. He possessed it for certain.
When you have that level of fame and accomplishment and mm-hmm. historical relevance, when you offer time and belonging to someone, mm-hmm. that is indelible, and it lives on as long as they do and longer because they tell everyone that they know.
No question.
That happened.
He had an ability, Marty, to be present with somebody, even for a brief moment. I think of this often, and this happens a lot here, right? If you're standing up by the oak tree and you're chatting with somebody, you can kind of feel their eyes darting around because you might be someone they want to talk to, but there might be somebody more interesting or more important. Arnold had a way of looking you in the eye when you were with him, and it might have been just the briefest of moments, but he was present with you in that moment that made you feel like you were had an audience with this man. There's a great lesson in that. And I'm in no way comparing myself to Arnold Palmer other than that if I'm talking to somebody up there at that tree, I try not to feel like my eyes are darting around trying to find somebody more important to talk to. We're here together. We're here at Augusta. Let's visit for a moment, you know?
I love that. I try to do the same.
It's hard sometimes.
I'm not always great at it.
Of course. Nor am I.
I do try. You talking about that emotion, I could see it in you.
Yeah.
I genuinely could see it in your eyes. And I had a moment this morning that I think I had a similar reaction. I asked Tiger Woods, your guy, about a sense in him, an energy that is overwhelmingly humble, that there's a humility in him right now just for the opportunity to the blessing to be here in the arena at Augusta National in this chapter of his life. What do you see? Do you buy into that?
1,000%. And I've been lucky enough to be there right in the front row from the time he was a freshman at Stanford when we met in 1995 at the Scarlet Course in Columbus, Ohio, when I was there to cover the NCAA championships through I was here the very first Masters, and you and I have discussed this, in 97 when he shattered the records, and I was here in 19 when he walked to that same spot and hugged his son and his daughter in the same spot where he hugged his mom and his dad. Incredible, impossible, you know, one chapter closes the other. It's almost like the book closes there, but it doesn't, because he does arrive with an opportunity to take the clubs into the arena, and all right, let's see what the old boy still got. And I recognize the same thing you do, Marty, that it's an appreciation for the opportunity. And it's not unusual, I think – all of us experience this to some degree, right? When we're younger men, we don't think we'll ever be older men. And then so you have there's a line, there's a book, too soon old, too late smart. And it's a great one. It's worth reading.
Just the title makes your eyebrows go, yep.
Well, but then as you get older and maybe wiser, you think, well, it's not too late. You know, I'm not too late to figure some stuff out. And I mean, we got to address the man's hair situation. I told him on the air. Look, I told him on the air. I said, I'm your GPS. You have to just embrace this, my man. And he just won't do it. He just won't. And we've got to sit him down and tell him to come
home.
Do
we need an intervention, Scotty?
I have tried. But he refuses my invite to join the Ball Brotherhood.
Why do you think he's refusing the invitation?
Because he said it himself. What's the word he said? He is stubborn. There's no greater proof that that man is stubborn than he refuses to join the Bald Brotherhood. But again, every man must arrive on his own time. And that train is late for Tiger. But there's still time to join us. But to get it back to the seriousness, the opportunity to step to that tee and be introduced. All right, let me bend down and put this peg in the ground. Let's see what we got. There's a time when you're younger that the idea that the sand in the hourglass is piling up doesn't even dawn on you. He knows that there's not a whole lot of sand left for him in these moments. And when you get to that point, I think you, especially when you reflect on the moments that he has been responsible for, you can't help but to be appreciative of the fact that you're here, and that as long as he is of a mind to do so, he will have earned the right to compete here. And like his old boy Fred Couples, you know, like that's his guy from way back. And you know, Freddie's still, he competed well into his 50s. Now he's had a bad back, but obviously not the same issues that Tiger has. So I mean, there's still, you know, there's still examples of guys that can do it, but Tiger knows his health could have prevented him from ever doing it at all, and he's incredibly grateful. And I love seeing that, because you and I talk so often about that word, And it's not that he wasn't grateful. It's just that I think when you're godlike, you don't ever consider what it is to be mortal. And I think he has considered the mortality, his own competitive mortality. I think he's considered that in ways that he maybe didn't ever think he'd have to.
Yeah, he said to me this morning that he didn't know, he doesn't know how many he has left, and he didn't know if he'd ever get another one.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've gone through what his body's gone through,
mm-hmm.
just to be in the arena, I love to see how rooted he is in it.
And you know what only he knows, and he wouldn't tell you, but only he knows. What did it take, right? What was he willing to endure simply for that opportunity? Right. Only he knows.
What do you think we should expect from him this week?
To have him give us that one moment where you go, wait a minute.
Yep.
It happened at Riviera. I mean, what did he, like, I want to say it was three in a row, something like that, to close around. And you sit up and you go, hold on now. All right?
It's in there.
I mean, but let's be reasonable too, right? Like, I think he'll make you feel. He'll give you that moment where you scoot out and squint your eyes and go, what are we looking at here? We got a chance. But then a lot of really good young players, man. And there are a lot of really good young players that show up, you know, with respect, but at the same time not giving a damn. In other words, Scottie Scheffler shows up, I'm pretty good. Like, I won last year. I'd like to win again. With respect, Tiger, you got a bunch of these. I'm just trying to get my second. John Rahm, I'm trying to get my first. Rory, I'm trying to finish this slam off. Jordan Spieth, I've done it before. I'd love to do it again. I mean, each man has his own agenda, and none of it involves Tiger. And so they are pursuing with an equal level of passion and want to. And that's going to, you know, it would require something hard to really believe as you and I sit here and chat before the event begins. But again, he and only he have an ability with that little 15-minute window to make you squint to see if maybe it could be around the corner.
You mentioned a couple right there.
Uh-huh.
Rory certainly chasing mm-hmm. the career slam and his first green jacket. John Rahm playing out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
A little lull of late, but playing tremendous golf. What couple storylines really stick out to you as we enter the week here?
Rory's first round. It's the most important thing. When I saw him at Southern Hills in Tulsa during a practice round, it was hotter than hell.
It was brutal. Ooh, out there.
Boy. And I just wandered up in the middle of a fairway during a practice round, as you do, and started chatting. And I just I was kidding, but I wasn't. I said, hey, that last round you had at Augusta, make that your first round here. And he laughed. He said, I'll do that. And if you recall, I believe he led after the first round in Southern Hills. And I thought, well, I mean, look at me. Motivational speaker, Scott Van Pelt. His first round here is what matters. When we last saw him here, he was holing out and chucking his club in the bunker and not knowing what to do with his hand, celebrating. He needs a round, doesn't need to shoot 64. But just give me something in the red on a Thursday. Put yourself in a place where you're not trying to go low on the weekend to get a backdoor top 10. Put yourself in the mix early. I feel like the first day for Rory is paramount, because it's been a while since anybody's come from outside the top 10, even after the first round to win. Here more than anywhere else, you better be in the mix early. And so that storyline is very, very interesting. I'm interested in Cam Smith. The last time we saw Cam play, a remarkable back nine at St. Andrews to chase down Rory, who we were just talking about. He was very honest about not being as sharp as he was a year ago when he arrived. You know, the live situation, haven't had as many events. They only play the three rounds. How competitively sharp are these guys? I don't know. We'll find out pretty quickly. But the long, long list of players that you would hope to arrive playing well to give us the anticipation that those storylines would be part of the week's chapters, all of them are in place. You know, I don't know who shows up that you're like, I don't really know about that. So, I mean, but look, because of that Christmas piece, you know, if you and I do this again next year, and I hope we do, I don't think I'll say, I don't know. We'll see. right? It's never that. It's always this eager sense of anticipation that even the other majors, as much as I enjoy them, none of the first rounds feel like as much like this to me as the Masters. Do you share that?
I personally don't think any other sporting event feels like
that?
This. My opinion is it is the reverence for the grounds. It is the difficulty in attaining access. It is the rarity of experiencing the energy and the majesty that is the course itself. I think it's there's a confluence of reasons for me.
That's really well said. Because other sporting events, like even like a, you know, you go to the biggest football games every week, right? And there's a, you know, Tiger Stadium at night, Tuscaloosa, wherever. Pick a spot. I don't want to single anyone out. But it's like that's an every week thing.
Yeah, it's awesome, but you can do it again. You may go to Augusta once.
Yeah,
if you're lucky.
And that first round is the one you've waited all year since the last round last year for.
That's right.
Yeah, I think you nailed that one.
That's right. Okay, two more things. Number one,
uh-huh.
I've heard 12. I've heard 15. I've even heard as wide a latitude as 20. How many of these guys have a chance to win?
Ooh. That's a great question. It's the smallest field, and it bottlenecks. I feel like it's more than you think, because how far down the list does that take us to get to Shane Lowry? You know, I don't know where he'd be on your list, but I saw him win at Port Rush, and I saw him finish, I think, T3 last year.
Last year, yeah.
So, I mean, where's he on your list? Because he's on mine. You know. Corey Connors wins a week ago. Like, could he play well enough? Well, I mean, it'd be a hell of a breakthrough. But I mean, he shows up with a whole lot of wind in his sails. I think it's more than you think. But I mean, to put a number on it, is it 30 guys? I don't know. Like, if you gave me the list and I said, like,
it is hard to do it. Just so you guys listen and understand, I didn't hand Van Pelt a list of people to look at. So,
no. But here's what I'd say. I mean, if you gave me, say, these 10 versus the field, I mean, heck, if you gave me I think it's a prop that's out there, like Rory, Rahm, and Scheffler are the field, be hard not to take that three, man.
No question, man.
But if you're telling me I get everybody else, I'd still probably take the field just on principle, because that means I get everybody else, right? You know? And then come Sunday night when it's Scheffler again, you go, that was dumb, you know? But I'd say, Marty, I think it's more than your brain initially thinks, because 10, 15 doesn't feel like enough. It feels like more than that.
If you emerged on Sunday here in victory and had a green jacket placed upon your back that you had on your person for a year, and you were coming back to Augusta on a Tuesday night to host all of the legends that also emerged victorious, what are you serving for dinner?
Crab cakes.
Mr. Maryland.
Crab cakes. Correct, proper Maryland crab cakes. Not those flat things somebody tries to serve you in somewhere in the middle of the country. All due respect, but don't serve me some flat thing that looks like a hockey puck.
What's a proper crab cake?
I'm fixing to tell you.
Okay, very good. Forgive me for the interruption.
That's quite all right. A proper crab cake ought to look something like bigger than a tennis ball, smaller than a softball, that had been formed in your hands if you cupped your hands together with back.
Like
lump.
A snowball.
Correct. Yes, perfectly said. And it should be that size. It should be loosely held together with just enough sort of whatever that, just breadcrumbs and whatever. But it should be essentially all crab meat, not the rest of that nonsense that's in those fake crab cakes. We would serve that. We would have some homemade peach pie. It's hard to get good peaches right now. We need Eastern Shore, Maryland, Delaware, summertime peaches. But I imagine Augusta National could probably wrangle.
Georgia.
They could wrangle. There you go.
They know a thing or two about a peach.
Fair point. Noted. So we'd have some peach pie, and then the rest just details. The crab cakes and the peach pie would be the cornerstones around which everything else. I'd serve a real nice salad. I'd say to my fellow champions, have you some salad there? We got nice hearts of palm, good tomatoes in there. It's just good. A little good roughage. You got to have that. We'd have some probably some hand-cut fries with some Old Bay on it also. And then we need some sort of vegetable, a nice steamed asparagus. A little steamed asparagus. And now everybody else can order off the menu. You don't like the crab cakes? To hell with you. Don't eat it. But We'd go crab cakes, peach pie, and the rest is the rest. Boy, that'd be fun.
That would be a blast. What are we having? A nice Pinot? Are we going to go with a thick, like heavy cab? What are we going to have?
I think you got to go in the price. I started to say brand name like seltzer drink. I don't want to get in trouble with anybody around here. Look, bro, it's open bar. Whatever you like. I'm not much of a wine drinker, much to my family's dismay. I'm the one sort of rogue non-wine drinker.
Though I've never had the blessing of being down there. You may have. I mean, you're the king of Augusta. Apparently, the wine cellar.
Oh no,
is out of this land.
No, I've not seen it. There's certain things about this place, and you and I have been lucky. And we've seen much of it. There are places I've not gone, and I don't think it's because I'm forbidden from seeing them, but I like knowing there are places that exist that I haven't gone and haven't seen, because it keeps a bit of that mystery about it.
There's beauty in the myth.
Well said again. I do think that, from my understanding, that it is a wine cellar that is perhaps unrivaled on planet Earth. And I mean, again, given the resources as they have at their disposal at this club, it would not be a surprise to find that whatever the best wine cellar is in the world that's out there somewhere else, it's probably not as good as what they've got here. I've not seen it.
Might be my mission.
I bet you could get in there.
You are a wonderful person. You have such amazing spirit, and you are one of the soundtracks of this amazing place, and
I appreciate
your friendship and your beautiful heart. It's inspiring to me, and I appreciate it.
You know how I feel. You and I have had a great friendship that in many ways was, I think, born out of this. We were friendly enough and knew each other and whatever else, but I think you and I come to this place every year and sit down and get a chance to renew our appreciation for one another, for the event. And I think you and I, maybe not everybody else does, but I think you and I see the world through a certain lens and try our best to help others maybe see some of that same light, see some of the good that's out there, because there's a whole lot of it, you know what I mean? And few places as good as this. You're the best, brother.
Scott is someone I've come to admire beyond words. He's right. We do have a kindred spirit, given the lens through which we both see life and the broad scope perspective of the master's influence and impact. His voice is synonymous with the beautiful cadence of this place, and I'm grateful for him and for his time. Thank you so much for offering your time to listen to Four Please Now Driving, the official Masters podcast. I'm your host, Marty Smith. We'll be back Wednesday. And Wednesday at the Masters means the Par 3 contest, a family affair, one of the traditions that separates this event from all else. It's kids, it's family, it's laughter and joy, coupled with the very best players on earth.